from the Sky News Centre at 5. A coroner's found that a soldier who died at an army barracks 20 years ago shot herself. The ruling that Private Cheryl James was not unlawfully killed follows a second inquest into her death. The 18-year-old was one of four soldiers who died at the base over 7 years. Our defence correspondent Ali Bunkle says Brian Barker QC didn't believe there was a motive to kill her.
He's being very clear and very forensic in his conclusions, which I think is what the family have always wanted. He said there was no evidence that the scene of death was staged. He said that Miss James shot herself, self-inflicted, he said.
The ringleader behind a plot to smuggle guns worth £100,000 into Britain has been jailed for 30 years. Harry Schilling, who's 26, was also given 5 years extended licence for trying to bring the weapons in from Eastern Europe via the River Medway in Kent. More than 100 bodies have been recovered off the coast of Libya after a boat carrying migrants capsized. And a rescue operation continues near Crete, where another boat sank, carrying hundreds more. At least four people have died there. FIFA claims banned ex-president Sepp Blatter and two other former officials paid themselves £55 million over the last 5 years. Jerome Valk and Marcus Kattner are named alongside Blatter, accused of signing off inflated salaries and bonuses. Change FIFA campaigner David Larkin says it doesn't read well.
Now suggesting that they can write themselves checks in secret is one more demonstration of the fact that this organization cannot be trusted, these leaders cannot be trusted, and that sport is out of control, and it's time to renegotiate the relationship between the public and sport.
The father of a seven-year-old who went missing for 5 days after being left in a Japanese forest as punishment has apologized. That's the latest. I'm Tanya Snugs.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Homes and Labour Councillor for the new Central Ward, Paul Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, next week the secret rulers of the Western world get together with the apex of the German government, all there to plan how to keep Britain in the European Union. We look behind the mainstream media's Wizard of Oz curtain to find out how our futures are decided behind closed doors by groups such as NATO and the Bilderbergers, who have some very real and disturbing connections to the Nazis and secret societies. Also on the EU referendum, news out in the last week that much bad news about the European control freakery is being held back until after the referendum. This isn't just a rumour, we'll document it. Also, Jimmy Savile, Hillsborough, Orgreave, Diana, the Birmingham Six, David Kelly, the Chilcot Inquiry, all to varying degrees, proven perjury by police and other officials who have never faced prosecution. Now, Deep Cut Barracks 2. We took a close look tonight at what's going on at Deep Cut and why Nicholas Blake QC's multi-million pound official inquiry in 2006 came to the ridiculous conclusion the four soldiers had committed suicide. And look at the four trainee soldiers who were almost certainly murdered at Deep Cut. We ask, is the British legal system the most corrupt in the world? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 24. Feeling humid on Saturday with showers and thundery conditions, sunnier on Sunday. Highs next week around 24 degrees Celsius with some thunderstorms, downpours in the beginning of the week, and sunnier but less humid towards the end of the week. That's humid next week. Next weekend, 11th and 12th of June, highs of 22, sunshine and showers. That was the two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook.com. So I'd like to welcome Cabinet Member for Homes and Labour Councillor for the new Central Ward, Paul Smith. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for inviting me along.
You've been catapulted in as a brand new councillor straight into the Cabinet. That's rather nice, isn't it?
Well, it's a mixture of very exciting and a little bit frightening.
Have you been involved in politics in Bristol before? What's your background?
Well, I was a councillor on City Council between 1988 and 1999. I was Labour candidate for Bristol West in 2010, and I keep popping up and being a bit awkward in various different places.
well, you'll probably be having people trying to be awkward with you now. We've got a majority Labour cabinet and a Labour mayor trying to tell you what to do. Give us a bit about your background. What's your day job, or what work have you done before you've got this job?
Well, I've worked in the social housing sector for nearly 30 years now in different guises. I've worked for the National Housing Federation, which is the trade body for housing associations, twice, in fact. Until last year, I worked for Asta Group, which is the largest housing association in the Southwest, as their head of intelligence and insight. I've also been chief executive of the Furniture Reuse Network, which is a national body based in Bristol, encouraging the reuse of household items as a way of alleviating poverty, as well as having environmental benefits. And I've worked in a range of different roles. At the moment, I'm, alongside my council role, I'm freelancing, mainly doing market intelligence work.
Now, okay, what does it mean to be doing intelligence work for a housing association?
Well, what you were doing was looking at, for instance, government policy and how that would affect the organisation, monitoring organisations that influence government. So the one that I spent a lot of time keeping a check on was the Policy Exchange, which is a free market think tank, which has been very influential, both with the coalition and with the current government. Also looked at new areas.
Hang on, because you've just rung a bell with me. Policy Exchange, these are the guys, I think I'm right in saying, who, it must be about 7 or 8 years ago now, actually manufactured a whole load of evidence against Muslims. They had a report which said that Muslim bookshops were selling radical books, and what they'd done is they'd actually faked receipts. This is Policy Exchange themselves, printed them out on a deskjet printer and presented them as evidence, which went right around the world 10 times before somebody at Newsnight noticed, hang on a minute, this evidence is has been forged. So these are the people, they're involved. Well, tell me a bit more about Policy Exchange's role in setting housing policy.
Well, as I say, they're a free market think tank, which basically fundamentally believe that the state should have no role and that the market should dictate everything that happens in our lives. And they've been very, very influential, as I say, both with the coalition and with the current government in terms of setting housing policy. So, for example, if you look at the law that's just been changed in the Housing and Planning Bill, which says that councils should sell off all their higher value properties to fund the right to buy for housing associations, that's a policy which has come up from the Policy Exchange. You also find that people who work for the Policy Exchange very often end up working for the government as direct advisors to ministers and secretaries of state. So although I don't agree with any of their views, when I was working in intelligence, part of my job was to track what they were saying, because it seemed to be that what they were saying 2 years later would become government policy.
And did you ever get a chance to hobnob with some of the people that make big decisions about housing? Because in a way, it's the most important thing any of us ever do, whether it's renting or buying, getting a mortgage. You know, we spend more money than almost anything else, at least most of us do. Obviously, the rich don't, but most people do. In fact, some rich people spend most of their money on housing. But it's a massive slice, an ever-increasing slice nowadays, of our pay packets is going to pay housing, for our housing. And yet, a lot of people would argue that the whole market is massively overpriced, that there's a bubble.
And I would agree with that. But the problem that we've had is that the actual ownership of housing is being concentrated into a smaller and smaller number of people's hands. And we've actually seen owner occupation sort of declining quite rapidly. And, you know, come back to your point about wage packets, for a lot of people in Bristol, their 50% or even more of their take-home pay is going to pay for their rent. It's not quite so bad if you're lucky enough to have a mortgage, because mortgage rates and interest rates are very low at the moment. But actually being able to afford to buy a house in Bristol, or even a flat, is out of the reach of a very, very large number of people.
So why is it that the poorest in society are paying massive slices? In fact, some of them are even being evicted because they can't afford to pay it, even though they're working 24/7. And yet the rich don't pay, almost don't pay anything. In fact, of course, if they've got their own home, they've already paid a mortgage on it. They're paying absolutely nothing at all, apart from a bit of council tax.
Well, obviously, what we've seen is, as wealth becomes concentrated in fewer hands and the amount of money that's available to poorer people becomes less, more and more of their money is on absolute essentials in their life, of which housing is probably one of the most essential. Why is that happening? Because we've got an incredibly unfair economic system which discriminates against the poorer people in society, and in fact not just the poorer people, but even people on average incomes are finding the amount of real spend that they've got has been declining over time.
So why have you spent your first week in your job trying to get people evicted from a council house so it can go — this is the one down in Avonmouth — so it can go to a private buyer? I mean, surely that goes against all your principles.
And I don't recognise that as what I've been doing in my first week in business, in the job.
Well, haven't
the first,
been
the first decision I made, Tony, was to stop all sales, all voluntary sales — there's some that we're forced to do — of housing and land. I've taken 80 hectares of land off the market. Every property that the council had earmarked for sale, I also took off the market, so that we're not selling them anymore. We called for the sale of the houses, including the one in Avonmouth, during the election, to be halted until after the election. I think the council's decision to continue with that breaches the electoral rules around not doing sensitive things in an election period. But we were locked in to a legal process.
What do you mean by that, about the electoral period? I mean, do you think
in the what's called the short campaign, which is usually about 3.5-4 weeks before the election?
This is the Purdah period, right?
Yeah, what's traditionally been called the Purdah period. A council or government is not allowed to do things which are politically controversial or make statements which might affect the outcome of the election result.
Okay, so they're doing the same with the referendum at the moment, aren't they? They're now saying that the central government is not allowed to campaign one way or the other with regard to the referendum, because we're now in that 4-week Purdah period. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about the local elections.
Yes.
Purdah, yeah.
Yeah, and so actually pushing forward with a sale of properties in an election period when it was very obviously a politically sensitive issue, because we as the opposition were opposed to the decision of George Ferguson to sell it, we would have expected the council to say, we will suspend this process until after the election. If George wins, he can continue to flog off council houses as he's been doing all through his period in office. If Labour gets in, then obviously they will halt those sales. And that what we've done is halt those sales. As I say, we've been left with a number of messes left by the previous administration. The council house sale, 15 houses, including the one in Avonmouth, was one of them. And it was something that neither myself nor Marvin really wanted to be happening. But the council, as I say, was locked into a legal contract to secure vacant possession of the house. I think that's going to resolve itself over this weekend, and we can all move on from that, what's been a very sort of disappointing start to the
so
programme.
So is that particular house in Avonmouth going to stay in as a council house, or is it going to be sold to the person that bought it at auction, or what?
Well, I think there are discussions going on, but my expectation is that, my understanding is the occupation is going to finish on Saturday. Because the occupiers have reason to believe that property will be returned as a council property.
So you've told them that you are going to keep it as a council house, have you?
I haven't told them.
You haven't said anything. Has Marvin told them anything? Who has told them? Why do they believe that then? Are they just spirited that out of the air?
Well, I'm sure they've got their sources.
Okay, sounds like an unofficial leak to me, but who knows. Mm-hmm. How many council houses are you in charge of then? Because your official title is Cabinet Member for Homes, isn't it?
Cabinet Member for Homes and Communities. And the total number of council houses, or obviously most of them are flats, is 27,500-ish.
And what's going to happen to that number over the next few years? Are there any plans to actually build more council homes?
Yeah, we are wanting to build more council homes, and we've actually got some that have that are starting to be built already. But there are two major things, which means that number will reduce. One is the right to buy itself. About 200 a year are being sold at the moment. There's been a sort of resurgence of the right to buy, which I guess is reflecting the increase in property values and people seeing an opportunity to becoming a homeowner. And the second
is low mortgage rates too. People looking at mortgages and thinking, crikey, that's a snip.
The second is that the government, as I mentioned earlier on, has decided to introduce right to buy to housing association tenants, and they've got no way of funding that. So they've come up with a wheeze, which is that councils will have to sell properties to fund the housing association right to buy, the discounts that tenants will get. So the government will be forcing us to sell our housing.
Well, we'll obviously look to see if there's ways of avoiding that. Let's just reel back a second there, Paul, because surely if a tenant then decides they want to buy a housing association place, that money's going to go to the housing association, surely, and so they don't need to fund it.
Well, it's a very good point. I guess the thing with right to buy is that what I should say is right to buy with a discount. So many housing association tenants will be able to get their properties at half price. But that, because housing associations are independent charities, they're not allowed to sell at half price or below market value. So the government has done a deal with the housing associations that they will fund the gap. They will fund the discount. And the government has decided that the way that they will do that is by forcing councils that have council housing to sell their council housing off.
That sounds bizarre. I mean, why should you
It's criminal. it's not bizarre. It's absolutely outrageous.
So that's almost like what you're saying there, is sort of stealing a council house from the council and giving it effectively to a housing association so they can give a discount to the housing association tenant. This is the first I've heard of this, Paul.
Well, it's disappointing because it's part of the Housing and Planning Act, which went through last month, and there's been a lot of challenge to it, particularly in the House of Lords. But the government rejected all of the... There were 13 amendments passed in the House of Lords. The government rejected them all. And we're now left with a housing policy, which is basically... the design of it is to destroy council housing in this country, which you shouldn't be surprised at because it's something that the Conservatives have always believed in. They believe in provision by the market, not by the state.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this sounds bizarre, doesn't it? But what's the ideology behind this? What's the thinking behind it from people like the Policy Exchange and the Conservative government?
Well, the ideology is just let's do it because we can get away with it. Because if you think about it, housing associations were set up to be independent of government, independent of local authorities. And the idea that you should sell something to somebody at less than its market price, well, that doesn't fit the market ideology either. So what we're really talking about is gerrymandering, really, because what they want to do is create a class of people, particularly in marginal constituencies, who will have been given free money by the government, which, of course, a lot of council house sales, that's what it boiled down to. People were given free money by the government, and not in substantial amounts of money either. We're talking about life-changing amounts of money, if you actually can take into account the capital gains. And that's money that could be used to house vulnerable people, but it's not being used. But, of course, there's no consistency in any of it. It's, I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder.
And it's almost, Paul, for housing association tenants, they're always saying, well, say, for example, the value of a property might be £150,000. Here's £75,000 for free. Take it or leave it.
Yes, and, quite a lot of people will probably take it.
if they can manage to raise
if they can raise the other 75, they have to. But you know what we found when the council house right to buy with a discount was introduced is that there were lenders particularly targeting people to lend them that money. And you know, I don't know the figures for Bristol, unfortunately, but I know that in London over a third of the houses that were sold through the right to buy are now buy to let properties. And so they end up in the private rented sector.
I imagine you could buy your £150,000. I'm giving people ideas here, but I mean, this is obviously what the government wants to happen, is that people could borrow the whatever it is, say in this case £75,000 to buy the place, get their £150,000 property, and then sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would be instantly in moving from the social rented to the private rented sector.
There's a restriction on them selling it for 5 years. But yeah, once that's over, then, you know, people can cash in on it. But it, in many respects, you know, where is that going to take them in terms of the housing market that we've got in Bristol?
Well, sounds to me like you're going to be the cabinet member for selling off homes.
Well, I don't want to sell any of them.
But I'm going to
do whatever I can to ensure that we don't sell them. And there may be ways in which we can find other ways of finding the money that we'll be forced to find for the government without selling council housing off. I mean, I would want to be is in a position where we saw the number of council houses in Bristol growing, not where they will be declining.
It's one of those things. It wouldn't surely be that difficult to raise money to build houses. Most people who are going to lend money, it's one of the most safest things to lend money to do, to you, Paul, to say, right, go off and build 1,000 council homes.
Yeah, I don't think they'll lend it to me personally, unfortunately. But in terms of the council, yeah, you're absolutely right. There are plenty of people who want to lend money to allow us to build. But the government restrictions mean that we can only borrow money against any surplus we've got in our income, and so our ability to borrow money from our existing council funding is very, very limited, and especially with changes that they've made in council rents, in a couple of years' time will become impossible. So we're taking a different route, which is why I've taken our land off of the market. Because what we intend to do is to set up our own housing development company so that we can build houses both for sale and for rent. And the profits from the housing for sale will be used to pay for new council housing. So borrowing for us, for housing associations, it's an option, although for them it's been reduced as well. But for us, borrowing is going to be incredibly difficult. But we are looking at how we can use our land to deliver more council housing. There also used to be, and this is another change that maybe you're not aware of, although I know you're very well read, is that the up until recently, about half of all the affordable housing, maybe we'll talk about what affordable means later.
Usually it means you can't afford it, doesn't
it? But it includes social housing and council housing, was funded through development agreements. With when the developer was building a housing estate, they would be expected to provide in Bristol 30% of them for affordable housing.
Well, we had this with the General Hospital site, for example, didn't we? The people who were developing that came back and said, actually, no, we're not going to put any affordable houses in there or social housing.
And Electricity House and in a number of other sites in Bristol as well. Absolutely right. And the government introduced a get-out-of-jail-free card where it said if you could prove that it wasn't viable for you to provide affordable housing, you didn't have to. And there's an awful lot of people making an awful lot of money proving that developments aren't viable to include affordable housing, because otherwise the developers might not make their 30% profit. But going back to the change in law, whereas Bristol could say our policy, even if they weren't really implementing it, and if you remember, George's Housing Commission actually said that they shouldn't try and enforce affordable housing for a 2-year period. Even if the council wasn't trying to enforce it, that 30%, under the new legislation, the first 20% has to go to starter homes, which will be properties of £200,000 and above, and not affordable rented housing. So we can no longer, or fairly soon, it's not been implemented yet, we will no longer be able to use the planning system to deliver new affordable housing. So again, the only lever really that we've got as a council is our land ownership, which again is why it was so absolutely crucial and a cornerstone of our election campaign that we took the housing off the market and we became the developer ourselves, rather than allowing developers to basically engage in land speculation within Bristol. We've got about 8,000 plots for homes in Bristol with planning permission which have not been built because of the property speculation that's going on in the city at the moment.
So is that old council land, or is this just land that the council have given developers planning permission for but they just haven't built? And why have they... Sorry, it's about 10 questions in one there. Mm. But why haven't they built these 8,000 homes?
Well, it's a mixture of all sorts of land. Some of it's land bought from the council. A lot of it's land bought privately. But basically, if you buy a plot of land without planning permission on it, it has a certain value. That's what you buy it at. You then go through the planning process and you get an outline planning permission to put housing on that site. The value of that site then increases significantly. And so you can make a bigger profit from selling that land on to somebody else than from building housing on it. So they then sell it to somebody else who then say, well, I've just paid a lot of money for this land. I could build some housing on it, but if I wait a few years, house prices will be higher and I'll make a bigger profit. Or maybe I'll hang on to it for a few years and sell this piece of land to somebody else because it's worth more and I can make a profit without actually having to go through that tiresome problem of building any housing on it. And so what we've got in Bristol is a combination of, well, basically property speculation. So land is changing hands, it's increasing in value, but it's not actually producing anything of any use to the people of Bristol. And of course, if you sell land in that way and you start extracting the value from the land for profits for speculators, then of course they can come back and say, well, it's no longer viable for us to put any affordable housing on it because the person who they bought it off of has taken the value that could have produced affordable housing into their bank balance.
I mean,
sorry, was that too complicated?
Well, no. I managed to keep my head around it. But I mean, surely is this slightly similar to what's happened with the carriage works over the years? This is a really well known site, isn't it, in Stokes Croft,
yes,
which has been probably 25 years, maybe 30 years, completely derelict.
Well, no, I think something very different has happened there,
and
it's, well, actually it's something else which you're right to point out. What some people do is they buy land and they hold it. They get it valued and they hold it in their asset register, in their books, their accounts for their company, to then borrow against that value. And so it's, again, it's not necessarily in their interest to develop it because developing it could change the valuation and they might have to sell it if they're building houses, for example, and therefore they can no longer borrow against it for other projects. So the carriage works, I think, was one of these asset-banked pieces of land that the person who owned it used to borrow against for other projects, as I understand it. And every time the council tried to put in a compulsory purchase on it, all of a sudden a planning application would come in, and when it went to court, the judge would say, well, there's a planning application here, there's obviously this site's going to be developed now, so it would be silly for the council to purchase it and stop that development going ahead. And this sort of game of cat and mouse has happened in the carriage works over decades.
I mean, isn't the way to fix this simply to tax land like that that's not being used, but if it's just unoccupied? Because I mean, that surely is a bit of a no-brainer. If somebody's got, you know, maybe the equivalent of 20 homes or just a bit of space that's not being used, offices or whatever, and it's not being rented out, there should be some sort of incentive on them to use it, shouldn't there?
Well, I actually agree with land tax. My simple answer to your question is yes.
But that's not necessarily land tax. What I'm saying is a kind of empty land. So if you're not using it, you then should get taxed to such an extent you might lose it through being taxed.
And again, you know, I would agree with that. I mean, in this country, we tax income, but we don't necessarily tax wealth. And so it actually locks up a huge amount of resource.
I wonder if maybe the people from the carriage works are going to try and move the carriage works over to Panama or the Cayman Islands. You know, I suppose that's feasible, isn't it?
There's a lot of optimism at the moment in the community that that site is actually going to be developed. But we might find out that, like the General Hospital and Electricity House and other schemes, we end up without any affordable housing in it.
Interesting. Martin, it does seem that somehow the casino economy world has moved into housing, and we need housing to work. We all need somewhere to live.
Well, it's always been like that, but it's getting worse. I mean, what's bizarre is the way they're turning the screw. I mean, the right to buy social housing almost seems like an afterthought on the back of an envelope, but it's going to come through. I mean, as I said earlier, these are supposedly independent organisations, but they're being told what to do with their own assets by the nanny government. What is interesting is that the Tories have agreed to join the administration, and I presume that they agree with the policy, for example, of taking land off the market. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the administration. And it may be that they can pull some strings in Westminster with their Tory friends to have Bristol get some wriggle room. I don't know what you think about that, Paul, but... Is that feasible, do you think?
Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, Martin, because in the mayoral election, all of the party candidates agreed that the council should set up its development arm mm-hmm. and be in a position to build council housing on council land. They weren't all particularly detailed in the way that would operate, but it did seem to me that there was remarkably locally a consensus around housing. I think that's partly because if you go out on the doorsteps and talk to people, the housing crisis is something that's touching so many lives within this city.
If you can step over the street homeless person that's there as well, because we've got the highest number of those outside London now, apparently.
Yeah, well, the housing market in Bristol is just becoming sort of ridiculous. And, you know, you sit down and you think sometimes, I wonder how people actually manage to live. And some people aren't managing. It used to be that street homeless, there were a very, very small number of people who had a number of problems, which meant it was difficult or impossible for them to sustain a tenancy and live in a flat or a housing without a huge amount of support. What we're finding now is that the homelessness is being driven by private landlords evicting people so they can put their rents up. And we've even got people who are going and doing a day job, actually, in some instances, living on the streets or living on people's sofas for a period of time in this city. Because the private sector rents, which picked up the people that the council and the housing associations, you know, didn't get to the top of their lists, the private rent sector is becoming flooded with people who can afford those higher level rents, and increasingly landlords are trying to get rents of £1,000 a month or more, rather than maybe renting out through the housing benefit system to somebody on a low income and getting half of that.
What about this £44 million? I don't know if you've come across that. It's a figure we were discussing with Crisis last week. They reckon it would cost £44 million spent nationally to actually end all street homelessness and to give city councils like ours in England the same sort of responsibilities as the Welsh councils for saying, I think I may be right in saying around about 50 days or 60 days to guarantee everybody that's street homeless a place in a hostel or somewhere. But that's apparently all it would cost, £54 million nationally to guarantee that, according to Crisis.
Well, Crisis, I mean, I haven't seen that report, but Crisis are a very reputable organisation. I'm sure there's some good justification for how they've come up with that figure. And obviously, you know, who wants to live in a prosperous city knowing that there are other people who just cannot afford to have a roof over their head or cannot access the support services to allow them to live either in a flat, a shared house or a hostel? You know, it's a real indictment of the way our society is becoming, that we can have people in those sorts of circumstances. And there are lots of people who aren't... I mean, street homeless is a very visible thing, but there are lots of people living in absolutely desperate circumstances who you don't see on the streets and are just really getting by from day to day.
So we've got this new cross-party cabinet, four men and six women, that Marvin Rees has put together. We've also got Green in it. We mentioned earlier on Claire Hiscott, the Conservative, who's doing education and skills. Fee Hance is doing city health and wellbeing. And also Claire Campion-Smith is going to be cabinet member for people. Have you had any cabinet meetings yet, Paul?
We haven't had any formal get-togethers yet. We've met informally a couple of times, sort of a sort of you know, getting to know each other type sessions. Obviously, Marvin's been speaking to each of us individually, but the first cabinet meeting I think is next week, the first formal one.
So, what do you think is the flavour of this new cabinet? Give us an idea of the sort of things that are on the first things on the agenda.
Well, obviously, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest issue is housing. But the reason why my job is homes and communities and not housing is because we're very keen to create balanced communities rather than creating ghettos of poverty and then gated communities elsewhere in the city. And so, in a sense, the first job for the cabinet is to be able to work together and see that if you do the wrong thing in one area, that has a knock-on effect to other areas of policy. So, for instance, if we concentrate poverty in certain areas of the city, that has a knock-on effect to the education services in those areas, to the business in those areas, to other social services. So, trying to create balanced communities is really at the top of our agenda. But then you've got, I guess, the hardy perennials of Bristol, the problems with transport, which never seem to go away, the huge disparities in health within the city, and the difference in life expectancies between the poorest and richest, and the difference in the life chances of children based upon the families, class, ethnicities that they're born into, rather than based upon their own abilities.
Can't help but feel sorry for poor old Mark Bradshaw returning to the cabinet with responsibility for transport. Mark, we're told by Marvin Rees, shares his determination to deliver a world-class, integrated, accessible and sustainable public transport system. Well, doesn't mention the other kinds of transport, which is the disaster that's going on the roads. And we hear this week, Bristol's traffic congestion means we're the slowest in Britain for driving, even worse than London, below 15 miles an hour for the first time ever. And the slowest in the whole of the country. That's actually measuring, they do it in quite a scientific way. They measure it on A roads that are going through the city, and that is the average speed on an A road during the rush hour. So Metro Bus isn't really going to change anything either, is it? All it's going to do is it's just going to cause a whole load of hold-ups whilst Metro Bus is being built. I think, if I'm right in saying, in a week's time, we're going to look at the M32 closing for nearly a week as well.
Yeah, somebody suggested whilst it's closed, we should start building housing on it. But the traffic problem is a hardy perennial in Bristol. I mean, I've been going around looking at housing sites. You know, sorry, I'm a bit boring because I'm concentrating on housing. But one of the things that you notice is that actually one of the constraining factors on building more housing is the transport infrastructure within the city. I mean, we've probably got a road network which is there to cope with 250,000 population, and you know, in Bristol itself, you know, it's not long before we're going to have a population of 500,000, and then if you take the bits of South Gloucestershire around it, much more than that. And do I think Metro Bus is going to solve the traffic problems of Bristol? Well, no, I don't.
So we're going to have a congestion charge, aren't we? Someone's going to come along and rub their hands and say, hey, we need a congestion charge, just like London. Everyone can pay to come in. It's so chock-a-block here, this is the only solution.
I haven't heard anybody mention a congestion charge yet.
Well, it's an opportunity to make money out of everyone's misery, isn't it? That's what governments seem to be quite good at that.
Yeah, I can't wait to make money out of your misery, Tony. But we're not talking about congestion charges, but we do need a rapidly improved public transport system within this city.
I mean, have we got any power to do that as a city, or is it just down to the first group? Because the main problem is, once you start, well, traffic starts to slow up, as we're seeing here, get down to 15 miles an hour, then the buses start becoming very unreliable, and people think, well, I can't rely on the bus anymore, so I'm going to have to use the car or a bike or something else.
Well, you can't really rely on any form of transport. I mean, I suppose you can rely on the bicycle. You know how long that will take you to get to certain places. And, you know, even over the last couple of months, it seems to have got noticeably worse in Bristol. And
that's the roadworks, isn't it?
It is partly the roadworks. I wonder also if there's been changes made to the way in which traffic lights are phased, which have an impact. Because we know that there are some people who are very keen on discouraging people at all costs to drive their car into Bristol. I'm not one of those. I think we have to recognise that different people have different pressures on them.
What you're saying, it sounds like a great conspiracy theory that someone's tweaking with the traffic lights to slow the cars
down.
Yeah,
it's the Bilderberg group are doing it, didn't you know?
Well, look, it's not impossible, is it, if someone has decided to do that? I mean, one of the things I looked at, for example, was these bonkers bus stops that Tim Kent, I think, introduced, where the buses stop in the middle of the road and the cyclists have to go out round the bus in order to get past them into oncoming traffic. And you think, well, that's going to slow everything up. It's bound to slow everything up. It's good for the buses, but bad for everybody else. Essentially, this is something which really needs sorting. Do you think there's going to be any different if we're sitting here chatting in 4 or 5 years' time, Paul? Or are we going to say, oh, well, have we managed to deal with that one?
Honestly, no. I mean, I think, you know, as a very minimum, Bristol needs a tram system, but it's never been considered that we've got the population to sustain one. But if you go to Manchester, Newcastle, where I went to university, and some other places, they've got metro and tram systems which do make it much easier to move people around.
Okay, well, let's just move on from that and talk about Saturday. Saturday, a huge rally to support refugees and a counter far right march in Bristol. This is tomorrow. The rally is due to take place at roughly the same time as a rally by neo-Nazis, which includes the leader of the English Defence League. It just so happens a few yards away. And to add to the problems, if we can call them that, the political demonstrations on Saturday, at the same time as all this, UKIP leader Nigel Farage and local right-wing Brexit MP Liam Fox will be speaking to an EU referendum rally at a city centre hotel. Martin, this sounds like a recipe for disaster tomorrow.
Well, not necessarily. If people want to demonstrate in favour of supporting refugees, I think it's the same groups that organised it previously. It's a fairly straightforward thing. If the neo-Nazis have their, or the English Defence League, whoever have their rally, hopefully much less well attended somewhere else, then there can't be much of a problem.
No, it's all going to be very close by, apparently. In the
well, all right. Well, I mean, these things happen. It's not Belfast. We'll get through it.
I mean, I've been to protests against EDF in Bristol before, and it seems that their numbers...
The EDL, or is that the energy company?
Sorry.
The energy company.
Yeah. Is it a Freudian slip there, I think? Yeah, I don't know if there's any French neo-Nazis coming along. But the EDL, it seems to me that it's a tiny bunch of people who come along. We probably won't even notice their ear. But I do hope, you know, that there's a strong showing for support for refugees in this city. Bristol is a city of sanctuary. It's been a trading port for much longer than I've been alive, several hundred years, and is always relied on international trade, sometimes quite, outrageous international trade, including slavery. But it's a city which has been built on its internationalism, and therefore we should be welcoming people into this city.
Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow. Also, there are lots of constituencies currently under investigation by police or the Electoral Commission, where there are something called the Road Trip 2015 was supporting candidates in those constituencies and yet wasn't declared in last year's general election. And we hear this week that the Conservatives have failed to block a police investigation into alleged general election fraud. This is Jason Beattie in the Daily Mirror on Wednesday. We hear now, Paul, that we've got Kent Police, West Yorkshire Police, Derbyshire Police, Greater Manchester, Warwickshire, Gloucestershire, Northamptonshire, Staffordshire, Cheshire, the Met, Nottinghamshire, Wiltshire, West Midlands, Avon and Somerset and Lancashire, all investigating the Conservatives for fraud at the election in their election expenses.
Yes, again, I mean, they've added an extension, haven't they, to the period in which they can investigate it, some of these areas. It suggests to me that they're either going to keep getting extensions, this runs past the next general election, or there'll just be a slap on the wrist from the Electoral Commission, or even a suggestion, you know, plague on all your houses, you're all doing things that allow you to do more than you should with the resources that you're supposed to have. I honestly don't think that a single Tory MP will be forced to face a by-election.
The district court judge in Kent, who ruled in the police favour, warned any conviction could see that individual 2015 election result Martin declared void.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they do. It just reminds us how we were talking about the unfairness of our society earlier. We're not quite in the same league as the United States of America yet, where any amount of money can be thrown at an election campaign and not even allowed to know who spent it. But we are increasingly becoming a not really we never were a democratic society, but we're becoming a very, very controlled oligarchy, aren't we?
Well, the question has to pop up then, really, about the referendum in a couple of weeks' time. Are we any guarantee that that won't be fixed, Martin?
I think because of the strength of feeling on both sides, I think attempts to fiddle the results will be pretty heavily policed by both camps. What's going to happen? Well, that's a speculation.
Paul, we had a chap called Dave Barmby in here a few weeks ago who was doing some kind of challenge, whether it's just a letter or a legal challenge, I'm not sure, to the people running this referendum, the returning officers or whatever they call for it, saying that he wanted local counts and that there was what was going to be happening is that the counts were going to happen locally, but the results won't be announced locally. What will happen is they'll go into big regional centres and there'll be a regional announcement of all the collation of all the local results in the referendum. But anyway, I wonder what you make of this and also which way you're going to vote.
Well, on the point about in the last referendum we had, which was on alternative vote, we did get constituency by constituency result, and really, I would like to see that in this EU referendum. And you know, who knows? Maybe we could split the country into bits that are staying and bits that are going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm voting in. I must say, I found the campaign on both sides to be sort of tedious and rather uninspiring, with, you know, an exchange of increasingly outrageous claims about what would happen if we left or if we stayed. It's not Project Fear. I think it's more like Project Farce. I mean, I'm an in voter, partly because I see Britain as being stronger, being part and of an international community, rather than some sort of little xenophobic little England.
But what about an international community that ends up with places like Greece, Italy, Spain, where the social policy is such a disaster? You've got over half of the young people unemployed, and there's nothing it seems they can do about it because the whole thing's run by bureaucrats, not by people they can elect.
Well, there's lots of things wrong with the European Union and its bureaucracy and the way that it deals with things. I think the issue with Greece has been much more linked to the Eurozone than the European Union, although sometimes it's difficult to separate the two. And obviously, the Eurozone is very much dominated by Germany in terms of deciding what happens, and Germany's got a right of centre government. But actually, you know, what do we think, you know, given that you're already saying that all of our elections are going to be fixed, we're going to possibly have Tory governments forever, what sort of social policy do you think that's going to generate if we're outside of the EU? The EU at least provides some sort of blockage to some of the sort of social policies of the government that we've currently
got. The current government, who might not always be here, of course. But anyway, there is also some speculation. Well,
we were an oligarchy, so that presumably means they will be.
Well, maybe. I mean, is Brussels not an oligarchy then? David Cameron's tenure as Prime Minister is in danger, regardless of the EU results, some Tories MPs have been claiming this week. If we win the referendum and come out of the EU, then the Prime Minister will resign straight away out of principle. Martin, we were discussing this week basically some leaks that I've got from well-placed journalists about the Prime Minister possibly resigning on the Friday, the 24th of June, the day after the referendum, whatever the result is.
Well, we know he was going to go before 2020 because he said so. People are positioning themselves for this follow-on struggle, and it may come to a head very quickly if the result is close, some people don't like it. I've got information, secret sources, if you like, that David Cameron is being blackmailed about his involvement in a trip to South Africa in 1999.
Is it blackmail a criminal offence, Martin? Should you report this to the police?
No, I'm just saying that he's his involvement in the trip to South Africa before the end of apartheid was to do with the sale of South Africa's nuclear weapons on the black market to the British government via Astra Holdings, which was set up by Stephen Koch, a former MI6 officer. And a little delegation went to buy three warheads from the South Africans. Delegation was Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren and David Cameron when he was working for Tory Central Office. And that eventually these weapons were sold to the British government at a profit to Astra Holdings.
What you're talking about is in the early 1990s, surely if this was going to happen at any time, it could have happened any time over the last, 6 years or so since David Cameron was Prime Minister.
No, well, it's a very complicated story, and
it's also a bit difficult to stand.
I cannot
up as
give
well.
You the person who's telling it to me either, because he doesn't want it to be known. But anyway, the fact is that Cameron is very much, he's a front man for bigger interests.
Well, whatever you say,
and he's going to be
that,
removed one way or the
whatever
other.
Whatever you say about
and somebody
that,
else is going to take over.
One of the things that's quite interesting, Paul, I think, is his unwillingness to debate head to head on the referendum issue on television, which I found extraordinary that the Prime Minister doesn't want to do any head to head debates on it.
Well, not only is it extraordinary that he doesn't want to do it, it's extraordinary that the media have let him not. I mean, obviously, the BBC are frightened to death these days of what's going to happen to them if they're too critical of the government, and the independent broadcasters and Sky. I don't know quite where they stand. I would assume that Sky, with its ownership, is probably backing Brexit. But the fact that the Prime Minister has been allowed not to debate with other people, I think, is
well, you can't force someone. I mean, I can't force you to debate, and I wouldn't want to with somebody. You've got to be standing there out of choice, surely.
Yeah, you would think it's a referendum with a clear choice one way or the other to set up a head-to-head debate between leading people of the two sides would be a normal thing. And it just seems to me extraordinary that it hasn't happened, and pressure was brought to bear in terms of the leadership debate in the general election, that there would have been something like that for this one.
Martin,
I mean, I saw David Cameron last night, sort of facing an audience. I actually thought, for him, he did reasonably well, but it was his usual patronising self, but. I just think that this debate over Europe and Brexit is that a lot of people will actually get to voting day feeling that they haven't had the information that they wanted to make a decision, and they don't really know which way to vote.
Well, if you haven't had the information, then you probably want to see the video called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit, which is one of my videos, which was an interview I did with Spanish Radio, which is up online, which has done... I was absolutely shocked to see is now over 320,000 views on YouTube, which was quite surprising. But Martin, the same thing is happening in the States, isn't it? Donald Trump's refusing to do debates with Bernie Sanders.
Well, he agreed that he would debate with Sanders at one stage, and then he changed his mind.
Oh, right, he's changed his mind.
And I think what Sanders is saying here, looking at this, he says, Trump changes his mind quite a lot. So,
in
actual fact, we're moving towards a situation where there are no rules about elections. There never were any rules, and there are going to be less and less. and you know, but the Tories are going to try and fix the constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which we know to be corrupt, particularly in inner city areas. But the whole of the balance of power in the House of Commons is going to be shifted on the basis of those electoral registers, which is gerrymandering, basically. Very similar to the sort of thing you saw happening in Northern Ireland.
Well, there's been a big change in the way that people can register to vote, hasn't there, Paul? And there's something like 5 million young people who are entitled to vote aren't registered.
About 20, I would say about 20% of the people on the register in my ward come the elections, which is Central Ward, which is, were not the people living in the properties. So the register was both inadequate in terms of the number of people on it and also inaccurate in the names that it had. I mean, there were whole areas of Bristol where I knocked on doors and the people living in the properties were not the people on the electoral register.
So that does sound like the electoral register is corrupt and possibly even more corrupted than it was before the changes.
Well, it's a question of whether you think it's corrupt or just that the system itself is now in a state almost of collapse in terms of it being possible to have an accurate register.
Well, it feeds back into what we're talking about housing earlier. Mm. Young people who can't get stable housing are the least likely to register.
Yeah.
They're the people who need to vote the most, and they're the least likely to be registered.
But if you think people are there are a lot of younger people who are moving every 6 months.
Yep.
And it's like registering to vote each time they move is hardly high on their agenda. So we are Margaret Thatcher used to talk about a home-owning democracy. We're moving to a situation where it might only be homeowners who actually have a vote.
Well, I think that's what's underlying all of this, especially, and also, of course, they're going to redraw the constituency boundaries on the existing electoral register.
The thing is, Paul, that was a situation before the 19th century Reform Acts and things like that, that only property owners could vote. People who didn't own property couldn't vote. So maybe that's where we're going.
Well, it does feel in all sorts of ways our economy is becoming Victorian.
Overstretched justice system is failing victims and witnesses. Well, that's not just me saying that. That's the Public Accounts Committee. I found this one on the House of Commons' own website. Committee report describes the system as bedeviled by long-standing poor performance, includes delays, inefficiencies and costs are being shunted from one part of the system to another. About two-thirds of Crown Court trials are delayed or don't go ahead at all, and only 55% of those that have been witnesses say they'd be prepared to do it again.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't read that report, and although I seem to have an opinion on everything, I haven't got enough knowledge about that.
I think one of the problems is that what the crisis people were saying about housing is that if you intervene early in any situation, you can save yourself money. But if you don't intervene early, for example, getting somebody registered and so on, or getting them a house, then of course the costs mount up. And putting people in prison, which we do an awful lot of, is the most expensive of all in terms of money.
But if those prisons are privatised, it makes some wonger for somebody.
It does.
Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock now. Thanks to our guests, Cabinet Member for Homes, Labour Councillor for the new Central Ward, Paul Smith. Next, we look at the Bilderbergers and also Deep Cut Barracks.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour